Aloha. Welcome to Island Issues, our weekly public affairs program about Hawaii Island's people, issues, and concerns over the air and online at koacountry1077.com and at lava1053.com. Now, here's your host, Sherry Bracken.
Aloha. Good Sunday morning. Welcome to Island Issues. We're here every Sunday, 6:30 a.m. Koa Country, 107.7 FM, 8 a.m. Lava, 105.3 FM. And of course, also there's the online listening. There are a lot of issues being discussed right now relative to Native Hawaiian rights. In February, the Na'i Aupuni organization will hold a convention, an AHA, on Oahu to talk about how to proceed with developing a Native Hawaiian form of government. In addition, as everybody knows, there's the controversy around Mauna Kea and to what extent it should have astronomy on top. As regular listeners know, a few weeks ago, we rebroadcast interviews with Dr. Keanu Sai about the overthrow of the Hawaiian Kingdom in 1893 and what some possible remedies are. In looking at the Hawaiian Kingdom and how it was, it reminded me of an interview I recorded back in 2012 with Dr. Tom Woods. He's the executive director of the Mission Houses Archives and Historic Site on Oahu. Dr. Woods has been involved in the history business for a long time, and Kona Historical Society asked him to do a study of Hawaiian Kingdom taxes so they could better understand land ownership, primarily in Kona. But in our interview, we talk about who owned land all over Hawaii Island, what kind of things they owned, who paid taxes, who owned the stores, and more. Now let's get to my conversation with Dr. Tom Woods. First, thank you so much, Dr. Woods, for being here with us.
Sherry, hi. It's my pleasure to be here.
Mission houses. Give us a really brief look at mission houses, because not everybody from Hawaii Island has been to the mission houses, so tell us what it is.
Well, mission houses is the location of the headquarters for the American Board of Commissioners of Foreign Missions, missionaries that came to Hawaii in 1820 and had mission stations in all of the islands. And it now contains the two oldest houses in the state of Hawaii, one built in 1821 and one built in 1831. And we have amazing archive that is one of the best for documenting 19th century life in Hawaii. It contains all of the journals and many of the letters written by missionaries, kept by missionaries. And also we have, surprisingly, the largest collection of Hawaiian language books in the world.
Wow. Somehow I would have thought that honor would have gone to Bishop Museum or something.
Well, it's partly because, of course, the missionaries were the ones who worked with the ali'i to develop Hawaiian written language. And then after that, of course, there were many textbooks and, of course, Bibles, Christian sorts of literature that were written. But they began teaching, and they needed Hawaiian language books to teach with. And so they began translating lots of books that were being used on the mainland of the United States, and they were then used here in Hawaiian.
Obviously, I really want to talk about your work with Kona Historical Society, but I'm intrigued. You've been in what I would call the history business for at least 25 years. What got you so interested in history?
Well, I think I've always been interested in history. I mean, my BA was in humanities and my MA and PhD were in American Studies. And I grew up on a farm. I was always interested in the history of agriculture. I sort of became an agricultural historian. And I was interested because my father actually was very involved in an organization called the National Farmers Organization in the 1960s. That was a very activist organization fighting for farmers' rights. And so I became involved in the Oliver Kelly Farm, which was a Minnesota Historical Society site. Oliver Kelly was the founder of the Grange, which was one of the first major national farmers' organizations. And it was a radical farmers' group in the late 1860s, early 1870s. And so I'd like to see some of the parallels between that organization and my father's involvement with the National Farmers Organization, for instance.
Well, I find that interesting because the Kelly Farm, it sounds like some of the work with which you were involved was in the period from 1850 to 1900, and that sort of parallels the time of the project that you undertook for Kona Historical Society. So tell us about the project for Kona Historical. Give us a broad overview, and then let's talk about the details.
Well, the connection between the Kelly Farm and Kona actually is there because in documenting the Kelly Farm and Oliver Kelly's farming activities, I used property tax records in Minnesota. And so I knew how valuable they could be. I was working with the Kona Historical Society. I'd been working with them since 1991 when we developed a self-study. And the self-study identified three areas that the Kona Historical Society should focus on. One, coffee farms in Kona, of course. One was ranching, and the other was the many stores that lined Mamalahoa Highway. So the first thing we did was we created the Kona Coffee Living History Farm, the old Uchida Farm. That's open to the public for visitation now. And then we developed the Greenwell General Store as an 1890 furnished store, and that's open to the public now. So the next project was to develop a ranch, a 19th century ranch, to fulfill that goal of having those three areas of history preserved and interpreted. So we started doing the planning and the research, and questions began arising. And whenever you develop a historic site, it's really important to do detailed research so that everything you do is based on accurate information. We started asking ourselves, who were the ranchers in Kona? And the sort of accepted wisdom was that it was primarily Haole ranchers. They were Caucasians who had come to Hawaii beginning mostly in the 1850s. But we had looked at enough records to suggest that, you know, maybe there were a lot of smaller Hawaiian ranchers and other ethnic groups that were ranching, and that in aggregate, those smaller ranches maybe equaled the ones that the Haoles had. So how would we find that out? I mean, most of that information is fairly anecdotal. You'll find small mentions of ranchers in, you know, different letters and some journals. The Henry Greenwell journals, of course, that the Kona Historical Society have are a great resource. But it isn't a way that you can quantify the number of ranchers. A natural way to go about it would have been to look in the population census, because population census usually, and for the kingdom it did too, is it would identify your occupation and your racial group. Unfortunately, the Kingdom of Hawaii census records, the manuscript census records that list individual people, are mostly gone. There are a few scattered pieces here and there, but there's no dependable body of information that you can look for. So where else can you go? Well, I wasn't sure if Hawaii had property taxes. I had never looked at that before. But Gene Greenwell, a former researcher for the Kona Historical Society, now passed away, had done a lot of work on Greenwell. And in looking through the records that she had at the Kona Historical Society archive, we did find a couple of property tax records for Henry Greenwell. So we knew they existed. So then we had to find out to what extent they existed. And so we did a sort of a discovery trip to the Hawaii State Archives and found that indeed there's a full run of property tax records. And for Kona, they go back to 1859. And we were interested in finding out who the ranchers were, mostly in the kingdom period up to 1890.
I heard you talk, and one of the things that you said was that Kona, the west side of Hawaii Island, somewhere between 1850 and 1890, was fairly unique compared to other areas in the state. Comment on that.
Well, Kona, of course, was a fairly rough and rugged area. I mean, it's famous for the Kona field system, which consisted of lots of small Hawaiian fields, but it wasn't suitable for large plantation agriculture. And, of course, other areas like Hamakua and Hilo on the other side of the island were. There was larger spaces that had some good soil on them, and Kona just didn't have that kind of resource. They also, of course, it's not on the rainy side, most of it anyway. It doesn't get enough rain for some of the plantation agriculture that you need. So ranching is what really happened in Kona, and that became sort of the economic base of Kona. And so that distinguishes it somewhat from the other side of the island.
Why was it important to look at the ethnicity of the ranchers? What was the significance of that?
Well, we wanted to know who the ranchers were and what ethnic group they were associated with, because it was important to us to understand the distribution of ranch animals and to know actually who the ranchers were and whether they were truly mostly Haole or whether they were Hawaiian and how that all broke out. As we worked through the tax records, we found incredible resource of information, because virtually everything was taxed in the 19th century. The tax manuscripts are really divided into two different sections. One is real property or land, and the other is personal property, which is everything else you own, basically. And as we started working with the tax records, we found that initially, early on, there were lots of animal taxes. In fact, they were some of the earliest property taxes. So the first taxes, like in 1846, were on cats and dogs. And the cat tax ended very quickly, but the dog tax continued throughout the 19th century. You had to pay $1 to license your dog, and then you had to pay another 10 cents to buy a license tag, which the dog had to have around its neck at all times, or the sheriff was supposed to shoot the dog. And the reason for that is that in the mid-19th century to the end of the 19th century, there was a huge problem with wild packs of dogs roaming the mountains, and they were destroying sheep and goats and had become a huge problem. So dogs were taxed as a way to control and reduce the number of dogs.
I want to go back. Before there were what we would call taxes, you spoke of a system in the Hawaiian kingdom called ho'okupu. The taxation system, by another name, existed. Tell us about the ho'okupu.
Well, ho'okupu means to cause to grow. It was basically a tribute that was provided to the ali'i by the maka'ainana. And the primary ho'okupu season was the makahiki season, which was timed at the rise of the Pleiades. And it was generally in October or early November. And it lasted for about 3 months. And during that period, most work was not supposed to happen, and war was kapu, and you had to pay your taxes, or you had to pay your tribute at that time. And also it was a period of games and hula and entertainment. And it was a time when Lono returned. So the system of ho'okupu was that there was a certain amount of goods that were provided by each family, and that was given to the konohiki for their particular part of land that they farmed.
And that was sort of like the overseer?
Yes, that was the overseer. And then there were a series of levels of chiefs, ahupua'a chief and the district chief and the island chief. And so each level of chief would take a part of that ho'okupu from the initial tribute. Apparently, the first ho'okupu began about 1570 to 1590 when Umi'aliloa was king of Hawaii. Umi'aliloa's father, Liloa, was the first to unite Hawaii. And Patrick Kirsch has written an interesting book about the whole evolution of Hawaii from family-based ohana groups to more of an archaic state. And part of it is the way the state becomes organized. Once you have someone who is ruling the entire state, you have to have administrators. It was also based on the notion that the king had his authority from God. And so you had a class of priests that emerged too. So about 1570, 1590, you have a class of rulers that are emerging and you have a class of priests. You have to have some way to support that class of rulers. So ho'okupu emerged about that time as a way to support that class of people.
What was the form of the ho'okupu? Were they giving crops or what exactly?
It varied in terms of exactly what it was. But William Richards, who was a missionary who came here in 1823, who was part of the second group, Richards was very much involved with the ali'i as an advisor. He became an advisor to Kamehameha III in 1838. At his request, and taught the chiefs all about constitutional government and political economy, as it was called at the time. And Richards talked about ho'okupu and the form it took. Basically, this was a system that ended about 1839, because 1840 was the first real systematic taxation form, first time a law was passed that really made taxation completely systematic. So Richards, looking back at ho'okupu, said that the ho'okupu before 1840 basically consisted of a hog, a dog, a fishnet, a fish line, a cluster of feathers, and 20 kapa. And, I mean, different people gave different accounts of exactly what it consisted of, and it was much more varied than that. But ho'okupu was given not just during the makahiki, but there was also a period in January when ho'okupu, a smaller offering, was given. And then whenever the chiefs were traveling, people in the area would also bring in goods to help support the retinue that was following the chiefs. And this could amount to a lot of things. There are some really excellent descriptions of that tribute by a missionary from Tahiti named Auna. And Auna describes some fairly extravagant gifts. So ho'okupu was a tribute that occurred two regularly scheduled times of the year, and then whenever the retinue of chiefs happened to be in the area.
Now, was the ho'okupu determined by somebody else that you had to give X in ho'okupu, or was it totally voluntary?
There's different opinions about that, and some people think that ho'okupu was completely different from what was later called auhau. Auhau was Western-style written tax laws, and that was something that occurred in a systematic way, as I said, in 1840. There were some scattered written tax laws before that, but it was it was well understood what was expected from each family, and there were consequences for not providing that particular offering.
And a brief interruption to remind you, this is Island Issues. I'm Sherry Bracken. We're here every Sunday, 6:30 a.m. Koa Country, 107.7 FM, 8 a.m. Lava 105.3 FM, and the interviews are also online, lava1053.com. KoaCountry1077.com. Click on Island Issues and then on the Island Issues microphone. Next Sunday, join me for a conversation with State Senator Josh Green and State Representative Richard Cregan. I'd like to know, as the legislative session is poised to start, what they plan to do relative to trying to fight dengue from a legislative perspective. Funding, bringing in additional resources, what? And since they're both doctors, I'll ask a few medical questions about dengue fever as well. Things that have been posed to me by listeners. If you have a question to pose, send me an email at info@lava105.com. The Sunday after that, my guest will be Mike Banfield. He's a mosquito expert, and he'll give us more information about those pesky creatures and how to eliminate them. My conversation today is with Dr. Tom Woods. He's executive director of the Mission House's Historic Site and Archive on Oahu. He did a study of Kona and Hawaii Island relative to property ownership in the late 1800s, commissioned by Kona Historical Society. I found it fascinating when we recorded it in 2012. I find it fascinating now. Let's get back to Dr. Tom Woods. So, Tom, you've mentioned almost everything under the Hawaiian Kingdom was taxed, not just real estate. Who determined what I would have that might be taxable? Who's doing that?
Tax assessors were appointed for each district. And they would go around, they would publish where they would be at certain times during tax season, and you were supposed to come in with a statement of all of the things that you own. Each of those things would be valued by the assessor, and then a tax would be applied to those. There was specific taxes for many of the animals, like dogs, for instance, but horses had a specific tax on them, mules, donkeys. All those things were taxed at a rate that changed from year to year. Other things were taxed at a rate called ad valorem, and ad valorem is a Latin phrase that means as to value. So whatever the resale value of that item was, that was taxable. And so you were supposed to basically voluntarily declare the value of your things. If you didn't do that, the assessor would come out to your home and basically inventory everything that you had and set a tax value on all of that. And these were records that were open to the public, so your neighbor could come and inspect what your declaration was. And I think that that was a pretty good indication that people tried to be somewhat honest. And also, up until about 1882, assessors and collectors were paid a commission on the amount of taxes they collected. So they were probably pretty aggressive in counting everything they possibly could.
Well, one thing I found fascinating, there were taxes on cows, but it would be a different tax if it was a cow used for beef or a cow that had a baby or the cow that could not have a baby. There were taxes on fences and houses. Talk more about that, because I find the taxation system to be incredibly complex.
It was very complicated, and taxes up until 1888, 1890 were in Hawaiian. So when we started this project, we, of course, first had to translate it all and then had to understand all of the agricultural words, because, of course, Kona was an agricultural place in the 19th century. So, for instance, milk cows were bipiwayu, so it's water cattle, basically. And they had a value that varied, of course, from year to year, but it was between $15 and $20 each, whereas herd cattle, po'o bipi, would maybe be worth between $7 and $10. And that was usually referred to probably steers. Bipi W, we believe, referred to Bipi Wahini. Apparently, when you look at the records and look at journals in association with it, referred to dry cows. Dry cows were worth less than cows that were, as farmers say, fresh or milking. And it's also probable that when they counted a Bipi Wayu, they were counting a cow and a calf by its side and taxing both of them. There are very few Bipi Keiki in the tax records. The reason for that is the cow-calf unit was counted as one under Bipi Wayu.
Once the system became a little more like taxes as we understand them, in what form were the taxes paid? currency or other things?
Yeah, it varied through time again. Early on, every male between the age of about 17 to 60 had to pay what was called a quino or a poll tax. That was simply for living in the kingdom. You had to pay a tax. And then you had to pay a school tax, which was about $2 for most of the 19th century. And then you also had to pay a road tax. The road tax, up until early 1880s, you could either pay cash or you could pay through labor. And labor was 6 8-hour days that you had to spend working on the roads. By 1890, you could no longer do the labor. You had to pay cash for that. And early on, Hawaii didn't have its own currency, of course, in most of the 19th century until the mid-1880s or so. And so frequently, tax law would actually require payment in Spanish dollars. Spanish dollars were acceptable mostly because they were the international standard for gold weight in those coins, because they had the most dependable weight of gold. Even before that, though, like in 1840s, there was a broad way of being able to pay your taxes. There was a transition. William Richards helped write those first tax laws in the 1840 law, and there was a transition that allowed Hawaiian tradition to remain for a long time. So you could still pay your taxes in hogs, with feathers, with anything that had value. Those were enumerated in the tax laws. But by about 1852 and after, tax law began to change when Western lawyers came in, basically, and began rewriting those laws. And then it became much more of a break with Hawaiian tradition and became much more money-oriented.
You mentioned that men paid a poll tax, implying they could vote. Could women vote back then?
No, women could not vote.
Could women own property?
Women could own property, and it was most common for women to own property when they were widowed. Then you would frequently see them owning property, though there are other cases. For instance, in Kona, when William Johnson died, he had three daughters and a son, and they were fairly young yet when he died. He had married Elizabeth, a Hawaiian woman, and so their children, of course, were half Hawaiian. He left a trust for his children that they could use by the time they were 21. So if you look at property tax records, you'll find a listing of his three daughters. And by 1875, his three daughters, they each own about 100 to 150 cattle. And so they have private property that is taxable because of the trust.
You know, you're talking about large amounts of property that people owned. I don't know if you have an average of the tax that somebody might owe, but talk about somebody's tax and what it would be today if they were paying the same kind of tax, because I'm beginning to think these people owed a lot of money to the Kingdom of Hawaii.
Well, the basic tax for a man, if you think about the basic tax that everybody had to pay, it's a dollar for a poll tax, it's okay. $2 for school tax, it was $2 for road tax. That's basic tax. So that's $5.
Okay.
And based on $5 in 1890 money, in today's dollars, it'd be about $25 per dollar. So you'd multiply 5 times 25, and what's that,
125.
That would be
Your basic tax.
Base tax.
And then above that is your cows, your dogs, your cats.
Any real estate or houses that you had. All your houses were taxed. All your animals were taxed. In the tax records, we can tell who owned fishnets, who owned canoes, skiffs. All of that stuff was taxable, and it was all enumerated.
So the tax records really speak not only to what people owned, but probably what people did, sort of the social structure of life in the area.
Yeah, they're wonderful for seeing who was associated with whom. For instance, if somebody was working for the Johnson family, for instance, there would be a notation by that person that said, May Johnson. So it suggests with Johnson. And that you see throughout the tax records. And you also see indication of when someone moved out of the district, and so you couldn't collect tax from them, and it tells where they went to. That's wonderful kind of information that you can harvest. You can also find out what people were sick from in the 19th century, because if you were so sick that you couldn't pay your taxes, the tax assessor had to identify what the illness was. So the tax records are this amazing source of information about everything people owned, who they were associated with, where they lived, who owned the property, what they were sick from. It's an amazing source of information.
So you started because you wanted to find out the ethnicity of the ranchers in Kona. What did you find out?
We did do this for 6 years, beginning with 1859 and ending with 1890. In 1890, And this is true for much of the 19th century. We found that Hawaiians owned the majority of the horses, mules, and donkeys.
And you're talking about ethnicity, not citizenship.
So I'm not talking about citizenship.
Okay.
I'm talking about Native Hawaiians.
Okay.
When I use the word Hawaiian, I mean, that's any kind of Hawaiian blood. But basically, when we did the property tax records, we use the same rules that were specified for the Hawaiian population census, and that stipulates that a child is always classified according to his mother's ethnicity. So for horses, Hawaiians own 72% of the horses in 1890. They owned 78% of the mules, 79% of the donkeys. They owned all the goats. There were only 5 sheep that were taxed in 1890. The sheep industry, the bottom fell out of it in the 1880s because of the wild dogs. There were 11,000 sheep taxed in Hawaii in 1875.
And those dogs ate all those sheep and all that time?
Didn't necessarily eat them all, but they did so much damage to the flocks, and it was such a difficult time to just manage the flocks that H.N. Greenwell and others who were the major sheep ranchers just abandoned it. And so they were no longer taxed. And, of course, they owned about 86% of dogs, too, at the time. In terms of cattle, which is one of the things that we were most interested in, too, we found that, indeed, when you really did aggregate all of the small Hawaiian ranchers, they came pretty close to owning almost as many cattle as the Haole ranchers. In 1890, Hawaiians owned 34% of the cattle, and Haoles owned 36% of the cattle. Already by 1890, the Portuguese, who had first arrived in a large number aboard the Priscilla in 1878, owned 25%. And milk cows, Haoles owned 45%. Portuguese owned a whopping 39%. Of course, they were from Madeira and the Azores and were used to doing dairy on tropical islands. So they did very well with that. In the end, and you see this throughout much of the 19th century, is that the ownership of the ranching animals, cattle, it was not that out of balance for most of the 19th century in terms of splitting that between the ethnic groups, but horses and mules and donkeys were, throughout the 19th century, was primarily owned by Hawaiians.
What were the biggest crops?
The biggest crop in terms of value in Kona is probably surprising to a lot of people because it wasn't taro, it wasn't sugarcane, as most people might assume, but it was ava.
Ava as in kava, as in the sort of soporific.
Yes, right.
Okay.
Right. In 1890, the value of the ava production was $16,420. In contrast, the value of the taro industry was only $206. And sugarcane, which was wholly grown in 1890 at the Halua Loa Plantation in Kona, that was valued at $2,500. So it was far and away the largest industry in terms of crops was ava. And the major growers of ava were really the Chinese.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Well, that brings me to stores. How many stores were there in Kona and who owned them?
That's the other thing about the tax records is they give us the great information about the stores and who the owners were and also what kind of merchandise they had, what the value of their merchandise was. And so in 1890, Chinese owned 12 stores in Kona. Hawaiians owned 7. There was only one Haole store. That was the Greenwell store. There was one Portuguese store. And then Haluvaloa Plantation had a plantation store. The merchandise value, some people may think, well, yeah, but the Chinese stores were small, but they weren't necessarily small. The Chinese value of their merchandise was $12,575, and the next closest was Hawaiian at $5,176. And there were some fairly large operators by this time. There was a Chinese company that had 3 stores, Akana Hale Kuai, and they had a store in Kainaliu, and they had $2,000 in merchandise. Kailua store had $700 in merchandise. They also had machinery at their stores, and I'm not sure what that kind of machinery was. It may have been coffee grinders or something like that.
You know, I'm noticing a distinct absence of Japanese in all the statistics you're talking about. Speak to that.
Well, the Japanese aren't included in the property tax records through 1890 because they really hadn't come yet. And if we had done later years, we would have found the Japanese. And that would have been interesting to see them entering into the store business and things like that, too. But plantations, on the other hand, were interesting. I mean, a lot of Japanese first came and started working in plantations. And when we did compare Konoside with Hiloside, we found that the ranching economy offered a way for newcomers and Hawaiians to enter a new market economy that was developing in Hawaii in the 19th century, especially really heating up in the 1880s. But if you look on the Hiloside and just glancing at the property tax records for the Hiloside, which, by the way, can be looked at on the Hawaii State Archives website because they have scanned the Hilo District tax records, it's page after page of nothing but poll tax. People owned nothing when they lived and worked at plantations. Plantation work was not a way to accumulate wealth and property.
Now, that's interesting to me. It sort of shows that there was, even at that time, a significant difference between the way life was on the east side of Hawaii Island and the way life was on the west side of Hawaii Island. And those differences, I think, in some way have informed how life has continued.
There's a letter that D.H. Nahino wrote to Sam Kippy, who was the governor of Hawaii Island in 1875, that's really interesting because there's this tremendous drop in the number of cattle and, to some extent, horses in the tax records and also mules. And Nahino writes this letter apologizing for not being able to count more. And he said that the reason that he hasn't been able to is, first of all, about 650 or so mules just simply disappeared from the records, couldn't be found anymore. And he said that many of the horses and cattle had been taken to the plantations on the Hilo side. And it seems to indicate in the property tax records that maybe Hawaiians were taking advantage of this more than some of the Haole ranchers were. They were selling a lot of their animals to the plantations.
You haven't mentioned coffee. Was coffee a crop in Kona in the 1890s?
Yes, coffee was a crop, and an important crop. In 1890, again, the Japanese hadn't come yet, so they hadn't really become a force in the coffee fields. It was primarily Hawaiians who were harvesting coffee in the coffee groves. Then apparently a lot of Chinese were buying coffee. Chinese merchants had a huge amount, a huge percentage of the coffee value in their store. And also the Halualoa plantation seems to have been the one that had the coffee mill, the only one that had the mill in Kona in 1890.
Dr. Tom Woods, what haven't I asked that listeners might want to know that you'd like to share?
I just want to emphasize what an incredible source of information the property tax ledgers are. And they're available at the Hawaii State Archives. If you're interested in your ancestry, if you're not able to find them in a population census because it doesn't exist, they're probably in the property tax records. And you can go and find a lot of information. You can track them year to year.
I forgot to ask you, what if people didn't have the income to pay those taxes? What was the penalty?
The collectors were empowered to seize property equal to value of the property tax that you owed.
Where can people read more if they wish to?
I published an article in the Hawaiian Journal of History, volume 45, 2011, and they can call the Hawaiian Historical Society.
Anything else before we say goodbye, Dr. Woods?
Well, thank you so much for the opportunity to talk about this project. It was a fascinating and really fun project to do.
Thank you so much to our listeners for being with us. This interview with Dr. Tom Woods first aired in 2012. Please join me next week for another Island Issues. I'm Sherry Bracken. Until then, please, let's all live and drive with aloha. Ahoi ho.
Thank you for listening to Island Issues. We welcome your comments and suggestions. Email us info@lava1053.com. Join us again next week for another Island Issues, a service of Hawaii Island's Mahalo Multimedia.